Welcome to another episode of the SaaS Podcast. I'm your host, Omar Khan, and this is a show where I interview proven founders and industry experts who share their stories, strategies, and insights to help you build, launch, and grow your SaaS business. In this episode, I talk to Adam Gavish, the co-founder and CEO of DoControl, a SaaS security solution that helps companies protect sensitive data stored in their SaaS applications. In 2020, while working as a product manager at Google, Adam faced the challenge of securely sharing sensitive data with external partners. The experience made him realize the need for a better way to balance security and productivity. Adam eventually teamed up with a friend to validate their idea. They leveraged their network to connect with 50 security professionals, spending 3 months interviewing them and digging into their challenges. After building confidence in their idea, the founders traveled to Israel for a week and pitched to 22 VCs. All of them but one rejected them. But thanks to that one VC, the founders raised a $3 million seed round. With funding secured, the founders formed a small team and collaborated with early design partners to develop an MVP. They also went back to the security professionals they'd interviewed in the hope of landing their first customer. After 3 months, they reached a point where one company saw enough value to pay $2,000 a year and became DoControl's first paying customer. To grow further, Adam had to take on a role of a SDR, even though he had no prior sales experience. He found himself sending hundreds of LinkedIn messages each week, hoping to book customer calls. Despite the challenge of learning sales from scratch, Adam persevered and slowly started to gain traction with customers. But as the company grew, the crowded cybersecurity market made it increasingly difficult for DoControl to communicate its unique value proposition, and this became an uphill battle for the founders. However, despite those challenges, the founders have so far grown DoControl into a multiple seven-figure ARR SaaS company, and they've raised $43 million in funding. In this episode, you'll learn how the founders validated the problem and solution through extensive customer interviews before building anything, how Adam navigated the balance between addressing customer feature requests and staying true to DoControl's core product vision, how Adam developed his sales skills and embraced the SDR role to grow DoControl's customer base in the early days, what strategies the founders used to refine their messaging and differentiate themselves in a competitive market dominated by large established players, and how Adam adapted his pitch and found new ways to communicate DoControl's value as the company expanded into the enterprise market. So I hope you enjoy it. There's a world where your CRM is powerful, easily configured, and deeply intuitive. Atio makes that a reality. Atio is built specifically for the next generation of companies. It syncs with your data sources, easily configures to their unique structures, and works for any go-to-market motion from self-serve to sales-led. Atio automatically enriches your contacts, syncs your emails and calendar, gives you powerful reports, and lets you quickly build Zapier-style automations. The next generation of companies deserve more than an inflexible, one-size-fits-all CRM. Join 11labs, Replicate, Modal, and more, and scale your startup to the next level. Get your free account at atio.com. That's ATTIO.com. Are you looking to sell your online business or buy one to start your entrepreneurial journey? Discover exciting opportunities with Bupos.com. Bupos is the number one platform for buying and selling profitable online businesses and the first to offer built-in acquisition financing for qualified buyers. At Bupos.com, you can explore their exclusive listings, browse listings from other marketplaces, or submit your own deal for approval. Bupos can offer pre-approved financing for recurring revenue businesses, allowing you to access fast funding with no personal guarantees. And their experienced M&A advisory team supports you every step of the way. To learn more, visit sasclub.io/Bupos. That's sasclub.io/BOOPOS. Sign up today and get qualified to sell your business or find your next deal. Hey, are you struggling to grow your SaaS business? As a SaaS founder, you know that having the right tools is crucial for growing your SaaS business effectively. But with so many options, choosing the best ones for your needs can be overwhelming. That's where the SaaS Toolkit comes in. This handy guide covers the 12 essential types of tools you need to supercharge your growth. Inside, you'll find a detailed look at tools successful SaaS startups have used to scale to seven figures and beyond. It gives you specific examples and makes practical recommendations to help you choose the right tools for your SaaS business. Don't miss out. Visit visit thesastoolkit.com to download your free copy and unlock faster growth for your SaaS business. That's thesastoolkit.com. Adam, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Do you have a favorite quote, something that inspires or motivates you that you can share with us?
There's one by Kobe Bryant, by Kobe Bryant and Shaq, where Shaq tell him, there is no me in team. But Kobe tell him, yeah, but it's I.
I love that. So tell us about Do Control. What does the product do? Who's it for? And what's the main problem that you're helping to solve?
Yes, absolutely. So Do Control is a SaaS security solution helping security teams understand, protect sensitive data stored in SaaS applications such as Microsoft SharePoint or Google Drive or Slack, Zoom, Jira, GitHub, and so on and so forth. We begin to help by just discovering how much data do you have, who owns it, how did it expose, how sensitive is it, and then helping you eliminate those holes and exposures to reduce what we call attack surface. And then by that, we significantly reduce the risk that organizations take in as a company. I know that now I have a lot less data exposed to the wrong person any given time. And moving forward, we help to build automation or workflows around those different business logic to either enable or restrict access data based on the business context.
Got it. Okay. Give us a sense of the size of the business. Where are you in terms of revenue, customers, size of team?
So we are in the early few millions of ARR across a couple of dozens of customers, primarily from the US. That's where our ideal customer profile is.
Got it. And I think you've raised 43 million.
Yeah, we raised seed A and B between 2020 to 2023. Yeah, so far so good.
And how big is the team?
We are a group of 50 people in the US and Israel.
Okay, cool. So let's kind of talk about where the idea for this business came from. It was founded in 2020. So where did the idea come from? What were you doing at the time?
Yeah, so I was a product manager at a company called Google, where I was in charge of one of the sensitive projects in launching a GovCloud solution for the federal market. And of course, as a product manager, I had to collaborate with third-party partners, research agencies, marketing, PR, and all of that. And of course, I shared information with them over Google Drive because, trying to work. And every couple of weeks, information security would just reach out to me via ticket and say, hey, remove that permission. They're not employees. I know they're not employees. I'm trying to work with them. But after several times, I went to the 8th floor. I got a bag of cookies. We had good cookies at Google. And I asked them, why are you doing it? And they told me, it's not you, it's me. We have over 100,000 employees. We can't possibly know the business context of why people are doing what they're doing. But one thing for sure, we can't have company information shared to the wrong person forever, which totally makes sense. But to me, I thought maybe there's a better way to do that with minimal frustration and more productivity.
Okay, so many people kind of come across these types of problems and then they just go back to work, right? They just go back to their day job, right? So what was it about this problem that felt, kind of made you want to go out and solve it? And what did you do? Like, how long did it take before you said, okay, I'm serious about this. I'm going to go and actually do something.
So I actually didn't want to open a startup. I had a good life, but my partner is very persuasive and very smart person. And, we decided to test the water, just talk to a bunch of security people here in New York, where I live, and really validate the problem. It's one thing to experience the problem, but it's another thing to validate that with the actual persona you could potentially sell a solution to. And we talked over the course of about 3 months, we talked with over 50 security professionals from various companies, large, public, super small startups, and they all mentioned there is a problem in this space, right? In different variations, but there is a problem, there is a pain. And that made me understand, okay, there might be something there. I'm convinced I'm in, but of course, to kick it off, you got to have funding. The technology is so complex, you can't possibly bootstrap it, right? And that's what we did. We flew to Israel for a week, booked 22 meetings with VCs. Everybody said no but one, but they only needed one.
Wow. So wait, so let's go back to the validation. So you say you spoke to about 50 security professionals. Were these people all in your network, or were they like strangers that you got time with?
So what we did is we reached out to all of our friends in the area that are kind of executives or even the leaders of companies, and we just asked them to connect to the security guy or girl. And then when we met those people, we asked them, hey, do you have other security people I can talk to in the city? And that's how you build a momentum. You build a database of just friendly, innovator security people who just love to give back to the community. None of them were people who we actually know. I couldn't reach out to my customers at Google, of course.
So basically, it sounds like you kind of tapped into your network to get those initial meetings through people that, you know, either they were in the security space or they knew somebody. And then you use that good old, who else do you know, who else should I talk to question, which many of us don't use, but it can work very well if you're good at it and you do it consistently. So that got you more doors open and more conversations started. What were you asking them? Because at that point, I guess you don't really know what problem you're solving.
No. I had some experience in doing some product research, and I knew that the one thing I should never do is ask very specific questions, because that limits the way of thinking. Instead, you just ask open-ended questions and let them talk and let the conversation flow. So we were asking things about, hey, you know, how do you know how much data you have in SaaS applications and how is it exposed on a high level? And then we let them speak. And you gotta pay attention to the tone of voice and body language and how they talk about those things. And wherever you feel like there is some slight frustration, you double down on that and dive deeper to better understand why did they react this way when we talked about, for example, managing permissions for third-party vendors. Why is it so annoying you? And then you do it again and again and again. It's like a muscle, right?
Okay, cool. So where did you land after those 50 conversations? Like you mentioned, okay, we flew out to Israel and we had those VC meetings booked, but what problem did you do? What was your pitch?
Yeah, of course. So after consolidating all the feedback we got from those 50 people, looking at the market, looking at existing players, looking at technology advanced, all those stuff, we landed on the idea that to solve for SaaS security, you have to understand SaaS applications. And existing solutions try to solve that by, leveraging your network traffic or your endpoint traffic and things that are really great, but they're not your actual SaaS application API where you can truly fetch the information, cross-reference different pieces of data from SaaS application and understand why the data is exposed and how can I fix it and things like that. That was the, very unpolished first pitch. And then the pitch, of course, evolved from every meeting to another, of course, based on the feedback we got. So I think that we had like maybe 22 different versions of the deck within a week.
Okay. You've sort of narrowed down the problem that you're going to solve. You've got deeper insights because you've had all these conversations with security professionals. You have your own experience from having worked at Google and seen firsthand some of these kind of security issues and risks and so on. But you didn't have a product.
Nope, nothing.
So in some sense, it's not that surprising that most of the VC said no, because they said, okay, you got an idea, but you don't have a product, you don't have customers, you don't have any traction. So why was it that one VC saw this differently?
I think when you raise a seed round, the majority of the decision is around the team and the potential and how big is the market and who else is in the market in terms of validating the market. less about what do they have today. Again, I'm talking specifically for the market I'm operating in, cybersecurity, right? Because they know in cybersecurity, for the most part, it's not about building a quick and dirty PLG SaaS solution that you can ship, right? It's not that. This is pretty cool, right, by the way. But it's not that. It's building an enterprise-focused solution with a bunch of enterprise-ready features that have nothing to do with your product, but you have to get them done. It takes time. It takes people. It takes money. And they get that. So I think at the beginning, they're trying to understand, okay, do we have the right team in place? Do we have the right market in place? Is there a potential there? And then they bet. It's a big bet. It's early stage.
Yeah. And I'm curious, like this VC that said yes, was that one of the earlier meetings you had or one of the last meetings that you had?
Good question. I was at something in the middle. I don't quite remember, but definitely not the early, definitely not the late, something in the middle.
So your pitch was getting better and better from each time you go and talk to people.
Even within the process with them, we got much better from the first bit to the, you know, advanced due diligence.
Okay, great. So how much did you raise and then what did you go and do with that money?
So we raised, today sounds nothing. We raised a humble round of $3 million. And so the first thing we did is, of course, putting together like a small SWAT team, people we work with, people we studied with, you know, close friends, people we trust, right? The second thing is we went back to those 50 CISOs, 50 security executives, and asked them, hey, we're kicking things off. We would love to partner with you on building the right solution. No commitment, no nothing. All we need is like maybe weekly, bi-weekly, 30-minute call with your team to make sure we're doing the right thing. And then I think we found maybe two.
Two of them said yes.
Two or three or something like that. You know, it's very, very, it's super hard, right? And then you talk to them and they tell you, okay, this, we need, first we need to understand how much data do we have. Okay, then you go back to your team and say, okay, let's connect to those apps. And the first feature will be, okay, give me all the data they have in, let's say, Google Drive, show it on the screen. Then you go back to them. And then they're going, and the feedback will be like, okay, we need analytics. We need to understand from an aggregation perspective how it looks like. And then the next one will be, okay, then we need to break it down by department because we need to solve it business unit by business unit and so on and so forth. You get more and more and more and more feedback and feature requests and then build accordingly until you get to a point where you find a flow, a user story, a use case they can work with. It could be very small, but it's something that provides value. That's the goal at the beginning, right? Just show them the value somehow. And I think it took us about 3 months to get there to a point where one of them really got like nice value. Like we uncovered information he didn't know about before, which is great. Then the next question is, okay, how much value is it for them to pay? You know, and that's so hard because then you're moving away from, okay, we have one flow, it works, it provides value, to what is the minimal set of flows providing value that this customer is willing to pay for? I don't care how much, I don't even care how much they pay, because for them to pay, it means they need to go to procurement, to legal, to finance, they need to pitch it internally, it requires work. If they are willing to do that, it means they really get the value. Otherwise, we're wasting their time, right? And so and that's what we wanted. We wanted a paying customer. You know? And I think they paid like $2,000, which is, it's like an iPhone and a half, right? It's nothing in enterprise sales.
What, $2,000 a month?
No, a year.
A year.
A year. So it's like, it's literally nothing. But again, it validates the fact that there is value. There's so much value. You went to procurement, legal, finance to get the contract done. That's what we wanted. And then you build it from there. And then, okay, 2,000, it's ridiculous. We're building an enterprise business. How do we make them pay 20, 50, 100? And that's where you really start to build the business.
So you said there were like two or three customers that were working with you. So presumably it was one of these that, you know, started paying you. Where did the next few come from? Like you had to find other people, right? Like you had to be on these initial two or three.
So that was an interesting part in the journey because I officially became an SDR, a sales development representative. I didn't have any experience with sales. Like I'm a product guy, I'm a software engineer. I didn't know how to sell, like sell, cold call. But that's what it takes, because this is a numbers game. There's hundreds of thousands of companies in the US, right? So many different people on LinkedIn. It's a numbers game. At the end of the day, somebody will answer. Somebody will reply. Somebody will be willing to go on a call and give it some feedback. So effectively, we build like a small pitch, and we sent it to so many security people. We hit the weekly limit in LinkedIn every single week, by definition.
So what were you doing? You were building a list of finding people on LinkedIn, and then sending them a message or a connection request with a message.
Yeah, you send them a message. Again, something super simple around, hey, I'm not selling to you anything. I'm trying to build a relationship. I'm working on an idea that I discovered at Google. Would love to get the feedback. And then, you know, let's say 5% of those really go on a call. And then 5% of the 5% maybe start to work with you as a design partner. Those are the numbers. It's like super hard. But the market is so huge that you hit it. It's okay. It just takes time and consistency. And it's not just me and my partner. So we're two. It's good.
How many messages or LinkedIn connection requests do you need to send to hit the limit on LinkedIn? Like, what are we talking about here?
When I started the journey, I had maybe 3,000 friend connection on LinkedIn. Today I have 17,000. So, but that's what it takes. Again, it's about getting the market awareness, market presence, getting to know people. You got to be likable. You got to really care about those people. You got to get really become interested in those people. Who are they? What's their background? What are they doing for a living? You know, and you build a relationship. And this is a valuable skill later on when you really try to close a deal, right? So yeah, so we discovered more potential design partners. And from 3, it became 10. And then from 1 paying customer, it became 5. From $2,000, I think we hit 12 and then 16. And then I will never forget the first customer we hit in like 25K a year. To me, that was becoming like a serious amount, right? 25K is a serious amount. But it gives you the confidence to keep pushing. Like, you know, the only reason they pay is because they get value.
Are you an entrepreneur looking to buy a profitable online business or a founder ready to sell? Bupass is the number one platform for buying and selling profitable online businesses. With their exclusive listings, as well as listings from other marketplaces and the option to submit your own deal for approval, Bupass has you covered. Plus, they're the first to offer built-in acquisition financing for qualified buyers of recurring revenue businesses, allowing you to access fast funding without personal guarantees. And their experienced M&A advisory team supports you every step of the way. To learn more, visit sasclub.io/Bupos. That's sasclub.io/BOOPOS. Sign up today and get qualified to start your entrepreneurial journey or sell your business at the right valuation with Bupos.com. So were you selling them on the same use case as that first customer? Or did you have to, like, as you started talking to these additional customers, the requirements just got, like, you had a long list of things that they wanted to solve? Or, you know, I'm kind of curious about how close were you with that first customer versus what everybody else wanted the next, you know, 9 or 10?
Yeah. So it's a delicate dance between what the customer want to what we think is best for overall customer base and what aligned with our vision. And so that's where, you know, luckily I was experienced as a product manager, so it wasn't new to me. It was new in terms of the pace. It's much faster on a startup versus Google, where I worked. But here, you kind of lead the customer gently to your roadmap and to what makes sense to other customers, and you try to understand if it makes sense for them as well, because they might not think about that angle that the other customer thought about. To cross-reference between the feedback, and you try to get to the minimal common denominator of feature requests that customers want, and then you ship it and see how they react.
And on, in terms of pricing, like going from 2,000 a year to 25,000 a year, that's great, right? You're kind of closer in the ballpark of where you want to be in selling these enterprise-type deals. But what were you doing with the pricing? Were you trying to, like, each sale, you know, incrementally kind of increase the price and test it? Or did you just say, okay, the 2000 thing was just the initial validation, we're now going to charge everybody 25K? Like, how did you get to that point of charging them that much?
Generally speaking, it comes down to the kind of value the customer get. Because the first customer got certain value, and then the 10th customer got a whole different product, whole different package. So it only makes sense to increase the price. But that's where a lot of founders are really scared, you know. What I've learned in the US is that cheap doesn't perceive as good. It's the opposite. When you charge more, you kind of make a perception that your product is worth it. It's expensive for a reason, because it's sort of a meaningful problem that it's super hard to solve on your own or with scripts or with the other product. And I think it works. And today, 25 is for us. You know, it used to be insane back then. But today, again, the product evolved so much, which has hundreds of thousands, if not a million. But you got to be determined to charge that amount.
It sounds like, you know, getting those initial customers and getting to that first million in ARR was largely through outbound sales, and with you being the SDR on the team. You told me earlier that it's like, you know, you mentioned you hadn't done that before, you didn't have a sales background, but you've really enjoyed doing that role. Just can you walk us through, like, how did you learn those skills? What were some of the things that you think are most important? Like, you know, if somebody's listening to this, they're in a position where, you know, they're a founder and maybe they're in that position where they have to go out and start selling, and they don't really know how to do that well, or you know, maybe they don't even know what an SDR is, right? So what advice would you give them, or give yourself back then, in terms of here's a good way to go about it and learning some of those skills that you need?
I think that for me specifically, for a founder, I'm not a sales executive. For me, selling is having a conversation with a customer where he doesn't think I'm selling, right? I'm not talking about pricing, let POV, I'm not pushing for doing something to get none of that. Instead, the opposite. Hey, I'm not selling anything, don't worry about it. I have a sales team for that, you know? And it gets the job done, because it kind of lowers down the pressure, like, because this is what we call buying fatigue in the market, where they don't have time to talk to so many vendors all the time. But when somebody approaches them and tell them, hey, I only need your feedback. I need to know what to build. It means a lot. I can change the industry. They feel like they're kind of becoming part of history. Like, I worked with that vendor when they were so young. I helped them shape the product. It kind of, it brings them pride in a way. And to me, the beauty in this story is, you know, it comes down to understanding people, what people want. People want to learn new things. People want to feel like they're part of something bigger. People want to stay on top of the latest technology, specifically in our space. And that's what I deliver them for them in the call.
Give me an example of that.
So I would talk with sales executives that, you know, maybe they were earlier in their career, and they wanted to know more vendors and more people and more VCs and more whatever. And I would just tell them, hey, you know, I would love to have you as part of our journey to help us build the best product possible. Did you hear me saying I would like to sell you? No, right? I would love to, you know, work with you on the product. It's a different way than telling you, hey, it costs 24K and here's the terms, sign here. It's different, you know? But it is selling, for sure.
So one is that mindset in terms of what you're describing there. It's just like, hey, I don't think of it as selling. I think of this as having a conversation, and I'm looking for feedback, and I'm just trying to, you know, add some value for them as well. So I think that's a great way to think about it. What else did you have to do or learn to be able to? Because you've got to get that. You got to find those people first. You got to figure out what kind of message to send them and get their attention to. You need to get to the point where they'll actually listen to the first word or the first sentence, right? So how did you learn to do that?
by failing a lot. Most of the messages you send at the beginning, they don't work. Nobody reply. So you change, you do a lot of A/B testing until something works. Then you're like, okay, I got that. And then the second thing is when you're actually doing a call with them, I failed many, many times. The pitch wasn't right. They didn't understand me. I didn't hit on the right problem. Sometimes I was too fast. Sometimes I didn't care about them enough. I didn't try to build a relationship. Like, there's a lot of moving pieces that I had to learn. And it just takes time and consistency. The more you do it, the better you are at it. And there's no magic formula. Every single founder has to find this for their own journey, right? There are not two pitches equal, you know?
Yeah, yeah, totally, totally. The other thing I think I want to try and understand is, like, with this, with a product like Do Control and the security space, number one, it's a pretty crowded market. And I know when you and I were chatting earlier, you said, hey, you know, getting really having a very specific problem that we're solving and being having super clear messaging is so important. Can you any help us understand, like, what was the process you went through to get to a point where you felt happy that maybe you didn't have the perfect messaging, but you had the messaging that got people's attention? Like, how did you get there?
I don't think you ever get there because the market is changing all the time, right? It's up and down all the time. When people are not buying, they start buying. And so I think the main thing you have to do is to really kind of suspect your messaging all the time and test it all the time. And test it in different mediums. You need to test it in your no-show campaigns, in your emails. You need to test it in how you follow up with prospects via email, in how you approach cold calling via LinkedIn, in how you interact with prospects on a call. You take all of that feedback from those different mediums and you just review it every once in a while, every few weeks, to nail down, okay, what worked and what didn't work. And I feel like if you pay attention to details like body language, voice tone on a call, you understand when people really understand you and where people lose you. You have to distinguish between the two. We reviewed a lot of recording of our calls. You know, we record our calls and we review them after the call to investigate and understand what works better. We have a lot of metrics on all the emails, open rate, click-through rate to understand what works better, right? Same goes for the website. And you always test it on the go. A successful messaging can only be measured by how quickly customers are willing to talk to you, right? If they don't understand, maybe don't understand the problem, maybe don't understand how you solve the problem, and then they're going to be hesitant. They might not want to talk to you. But if they're talking to you, they're going to go on a call, and they're going to work with you, it means that they understand, right? It doesn't have to be perfect. It needs to be understandable.
Right, right. Yeah, I spoke to a founder recently who told me that they really struggle with their messaging, and they would get on a customer meeting. So there was something they said that would get them in the meeting, but then they were having to spend 80% of that time explaining what the product did, right? And then that's when you know that there's a problem, because, you know, it's like, your customer should kind of have known that at least a basic level before they get to the meeting.
Not necessarily, because those are different things. The first goal is, how do I lure them in for a meeting? That one type of messaging. The second thing is, okay, how do I get them excited within the meeting? That's a different thing. And then when they become the customer, they come to renew. What ROI messaging do I use to help them renew? Those are very different messaging frameworks that you have to put in place, right? I don't think that, you know, the fact they understand what you do and come to a meeting right away means they're going to understand the product right away. Those are two different things.
Yeah, you know, that's a fair point. I think that the same goes for, like, if you have messaging which gets people's attention and interest, doesn't necessarily mean that's the messaging that gets you to close the sale. It just got them to click the link on the website or whatever, right? So you've got two problems here, right? As far as I can see, probably lots of other problems, but the two that I'm seeing here, one is you've got to figure out that messaging, and you've got to get the meeting with the customer and persuade them that, you know, you can solve these problems that they have. The second problem that you have is you are a startup in an industry with a lot of established incumbents, players who've been around for a long time, who probably have more, you know, brand equity and trust because of the time they've been around. So you've also got to persuade these people, probably, you know, not that they're going to maybe not use, you know, some of those products in place of yours.
Yeah, you got to be very careful there, because if you're going to talk trash on your competitors, you know, customers don't like that, right? It's a sign of weakness, in my opinion. Instead, I would just talk about identify what kind of gap they have from their current solution. That's a very legit qualifying question. It's one of the first questions, actually. What doesn't work for you? Why are you here on a call with me, right? And then they tell you, this doesn't work, or this or that. And you use that to establish your differentiation points. A critical component of the messaging is, how am I differentiated? Why me? Why is it better? Do I have a faster product? Do I have a more reliable product? Is it easier to maintain? Is it easier to roll out? There are many, many things you can say. And the faster you find those differentiation points, especially from the larger vendors, the better your position in a call with a prospect, because they smell that. They smell whether you understand or don't understand the space. And when you have a very clear differentiation point, it gives the prospect the confidence that you know what you're doing. You're here for a reason. Let's go test it out.
So let's say you're talking to a prospect today. What's your differentiation point? So if they say, you know,
I'm going to tell them that, hey, do control is event-driven, which means that whenever users perform any kind of activity on SaaS application, that application push that event activity to do control in near real time, so that we can really monitor for user behavior with very low latency, versus larger companies that pull those events every couple of hours and then you have blind spots. That's just an example, right? Another example is the larger vendors, they tend to scan your data for PII, PCI, PHI, like sensitive data, right? Which is excellent, but it's just one signal. If somebody is sharing PII externally, it could be totally legit, but it could also be very dangerous. To distinguish between the two, our differentiation point is that we also connect to your HR software to understand the employment status. If the person is leaving, it's a high-risk situation. We connect to your identity provider to understand what group the person is coming from, whether or not they should be dealing with sensitive data. We scan the actual data for the classification, of course. And we also reach out to the end user to ask for their input. And that's why you bring something fresh, something new, something they haven't heard about. Get them excited, get them to wanting to try it out. You touch on the pain with a new technology that can solve a gap they acknowledge just previously.
Yeah. No, I like that. Yeah. I think it's sometimes we think that there's one differentiation point. And the example you just gave is there can be multiple ways that you're different.
There have to be multiple ways, because again, the more you grow the business, the more, you know, differentiation points you have to find in order to really justify for larger deals with the larger customers. And, you know, I'm asking them to leave a very legit product behind and come to me. So it's better worth for them.
Yeah. And typically, what does your sales cycle look like? Like, how long does it take for you to close these types of deals? Because, you know, this is kind of one of those places where it's like, I heard this quote where somebody said to me, or somebody said like, hey, if I do my job right, like nobody cares, but if I screw up, I get fired or something, right? And it kind of hits me like that kind of the security space is a little bit like that, where these people are doing these jobs and trying to keep the organization safe. And if they're doing their jobs, it's like nobody cares, right? But to make a big decision like this and change something out, and then to have to go and get the decisions made internally, and like you talked about, like how to get the funds and the budget and the authorization, it sounds like it's not an overnight thing.
I think it used to be like that for security people, but a little bit less today, because today they're really business enablers, not just security, the guardian of your, you know, crown jewel. Today, they really enable the business in a secure manner. Right? I'm enabling you to use, I don't know, ChatGPT, but without the, you know, sensitive data exposed to ChatGPT. But I'm enabling you to use that, right? I'm enabling you to collaborate via Slack, but whenever there's sensitive data involved, I'm going to intervene gently to make things right. But it's always about an enablement today. It's different, I think, a little bit different. Going back to the question for sales cycle, anywhere between 2-3 months to 6-8 months, depending on the company side. We're working on Fortune 500 deal now. Takes forever. But we also close deals within the same quarter with smaller account, you know, 1,000, 1,500 people organization. Those are much easier to work with.
Are you still doing sales today?
Of course, every single day. You have to.
You really do love it.
I mean, to me, sales is people, and I like people. You know, getting to know new people every single day, you know, laughing about things, laughing about the Cowboys losing again, you know, whatever it is. It's fun. But that's my job. I have to support my sales team because they bring me at the, you know, strategic executive to kind of provide FaceTime to their customers to make them feel super important because the CEO is in the call. It's the dynamic, right? So I'm not cold calling customers anymore because I have a great team doing that today, but I am definitely hands-on helping them to shape the sales playbook, making sure that, you know, product and sales are aligned on, you know, what our value proposition and how the roadmap looks like.
So you really, yeah, it's funny. It's like you kind of hadn't done any sales before and now you've realized that you actually really enjoy it. And I think a lot of founders, maybe if they put the same mindset as you in terms of, you know, it's an opportunity to connect with people and meet people and just have conversations where you're learning and maybe you can help, maybe you can't. It kind of takes a lot of the stigma away about sales, I think.
I think a founder doing sales is very different from a salesperson doing sales because a salesperson, by definition, is measured by, you know, new money, attainment, quota, whatever. A founder is expected to fail at sales all the time. Like, for sure. Like, but your job is not to really do sales. Your job is to do what it takes for the sales team to do sales, right? To be there and understand the right context from the prospect, to shape the playbook for the sales team, for them to do sales. So it's very different from a classic sales guy. Maybe that's why I like it.
Yeah. All right. We should wrap up. I'm going to get on to the lightning round. I've got 7 quick fire questions for you. What's one of the best pieces of business advice you've received?
One of the best business advice I received is that always hire people who are better than you in a certain domain. Always.
What book would you recommend to our audience and why?
0 to 1 by Peter Thiel. It's amazing.
What's one attribute or characteristic in your mind of a successful founder?
Optimistic.
What's your favorite personal productivity tool or habit?
I'm the king of reminders. So I don't need to remember anything because I'm utilizing Gmail snooze, Slack reminders, all of that good stuff. So every Monday 8 a.m. I have probably 30 or 40 different emails coming back to me to make sure I'm staying on top of everything.
Love it. King of reminders. What's a new or crazy business idea you'd love to pursue if you had the time?
Ooh, I would love, I just talked about it this week with our chief of staff. I would love to build a product where you input question and answers representing your sales playbook. And that product would use generative AI to output an amazing sales playbook diagram, a couple of slides, and then also take recordings that can autocorrect your salespeople against the question and answers provided earlier. To me, that's amazing.
There you go. What's an interesting or fun fact about you that most people don't know?
I'm still a gamer. I'm playing Counter-Strike every week. I love it. It's my meditation.
Your meditation. And finally, what's one of your most important passions outside of your work, other than gaming?
Outside of work, I love my family. I love my kids. They're the world to me. I love growing them. I love laughing with them. Besides that, I really love playing basketball, skiing, and playing poker.
Poker, I love it. Cool. Adam, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a pleasure chatting and unpacking the story of Do Control. If people want to check out the product, they can go to docontrol.io. And if folks want to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
LinkedIn.
LinkedIn, of course. We'll include a link to your profile in the show notes. So thanks so much. It's been a pleasure. Wish you and the team the best of success.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Cheers. Do you dream of owning a profitable online business, or are you looking to sell yours? Bupost.com is the number one platform for entrepreneurs and founders alike. With Bupost, you can discover exclusive listings, browse listings from other marketplaces, or submit your own deal for approval. As the first platform to offer built-in acquisition financing for qualified buyers, Bupost makes it easier than ever to acquire a recurring revenue business without personal guarantees. Their experienced M&A advisory team is dedicated to supporting you throughout the process, ensuring a smooth transaction. Don't miss out on this exciting opportunity. To learn more, visit sasclub.io/bupos. That's sasclub.io/BOOPOS. Sign up today and get qualified to sell your business or find your next venture. There's a world where your CRM is powerful, easily configured, and deeply intuitive. Atio makes that a reality. Atio is built specifically for the next generation of companies. It syncs with your data sources, easily configures to their unique structures, and works for any go-to-market motion from self-serve to sales-led. Atio automatically enriches your contacts, syncs your emails and calendar, gives you powerful reports, and lets you quickly build Zapier-style automations. The next generation of companies deserve more than an inflexible, one-size-fits-all CRM. Join 11 Labs, Replicate, Modal, and more, and scale your startup to the next level. Get your free account at atio.com. That's ATTIO.com. Attention SaaS founders, are you determined to scale your B2B business to that coveted $1 million ARR milestone? I've got something that can help you get there faster. Introducing the SaaS Club newsletter, your weekly companion on the journey to SaaS success. Packed with proven strategies, practical insights, and exclusive interviews with B2B SaaS founders who've been where you are, this newsletter is your ticket to accelerated growth. Each week, in just 5 minutes, you'll gain access to a treasure trove of growth tactics, lessons learned, and insider tips to help you navigate the challenges of the early stages and scale your business to seven figures and beyond. So why wait? Become part of a 4,000 plus strong community of SaaS founders and entrepreneurs who are already harnessing these insights to drive their growth. Visit sasclub.io/newsletter and subscribe to the SaaS Club newsletter today. Gain the support and expertise you need to keep forging ahead on your SaaS journey.